said, "Please, God, take good care of my uncle up there in heaven. Amen." That's what I said last night. I don't know what I'm going to say tonight.
If I think that I'm going to get a bad mark on my exam, you know, and Mommy and Daddy will get mad at me, so I close my hands and I start praying to God that Mommy and Daddy won't get mad at me.
I ask him sometimes to help me be a better boy and to forgive all my sins, the lies I tell, and things I do bad.
I pray before I go to bed, and sometimes before I eat, and sometimes, of course, in church. Well, one thing, you have to kneel down, stand up, sit down, kneel down, stand up, and it gets you tired.
Mostly before I get a beating, I always say a prayer. God, please make my burdens light. Please put something into my mother's head that would make her forget about the beating.
Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost, as it was at the
beginning.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I die
before, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
God bless
thy kingdom
my brother,
come,
my father,
thy will be done,
my brother,
on
Eloise,
earth as it is in heaven.
Aunts,
give us this
uncle,
day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
was Rump State, new project of Mark Morgan from Sightings. Evil Vista, the name of the track. The album is Psychic Sidekick. We heard VCSR, a four-person synth project from 1979, 1980-ish, and an untitled track, number 41. Tony Schwartz talking to children about God in 1967. Also in there and behind us now, Mark Vernon and the sounds of the modern hospital. Pierre Vassilou did Alentour de Lune. We heard Michelangelo with a song whose title I did not enter. Oops, sorry. Amy and Elle in the Places did the Cimarron Banks. Erasmus Carlos with Mayo Mar. And Gal Costa at the top of the set. Negra Moore, her version of Bob Dylan's It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. As is this program, Baby Blue. I'll see you next week. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Mark. Tectonic is next.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. I've got a great interview to share with you today. We're going to be speaking with Evan Selinger and Albert Foxconn. I'm going to tell you in a moment about their book, but let me just give you a little bit of context. We have heard over the years this phrase, move fast and break things. This was a kind of a slogan that Mark Zuckerberg promoted within Facebook years ago. I think he claims to have backed off of it in recent years, but you can see the effects of that approach in a lot of different places across Silicon Valley and beyond. And to be clear, it's not just Facebook that adopted this approach. There is this general interest in what's called disruptive innovation, which is just another way of saying moving fast and breaking things. And big tech and its vassal firms and startups have pursued this as an agenda for a number of years, and we can see the result of this approach all around us. First of all, we can acknowledge that they have indeed moved fast. The changes that we have seen have come onto this society with blinding speed. So I'm not going to give them credit per se, but I will agree with them that Mark Zuckerberg's slogan turned out to have been pursued with some integrity, with the same intent that the words seem to point to. They claimed to want to move fast, and they did. And the second half of this slogan is breaking things, and yes, in fact, they have broken things. What are some things that the bros in Silicon Valley have ended up breaking with their move fast and break things approach? They've broken the social fabric. They've broken the environment in many places. They've broken our privacy. They've broken the economy. They've broken our politics, our media, our healthcare, our education, and I could go on. Just about everything that surrounds us, is under pressure from their so-called disruptive innovation or their move fast and break things approach. And all of this is to say, friends, that it's long past time that we tried something else, that we tried a different approach from the Silicon Valley agenda of moving fast and breaking things. And I'm happy to say that our guests today have a proposal in a book form of just such an alternative approach. The guests are co-authors, Evan Selinger and Albert Fox Kahn. They have written a book with their counterproposal. And instead of Move Fast and Break Things, the name of their book is Move Slow and Upgrade. And the subtitle is The Power of Incremental Innovation, which is, I take it, as a response to disruptive innovation. So we're going to be speaking with Evan and Albert about Move Slow and Upgrade. And you'll hear at the beginning of the interview that Albert's been on the show in the past, and Evan, somewhat indirectly, has been on the show. And so I'm really happy to bring them onto Tectonic and discuss their book, which I liked a lot. And by the way, if you want a link to the book, you can find it on the Tectonic episode page, which is on the Tectonic website, which is at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Let's go ahead now and listen to the interview here on Tectonic. Evan Selinger and Albert Fox Kahn, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Thank you so much.
I should say welcome back to you, Albert, since you were on the show a couple of times in past years talking about your work with STOP, that is the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project. And Evan, you were, I guess, indirectly on the show because years ago I did a show on your previous book, Reengineering Humanity. But today we're going to talk about the book that both of you have written. It's called Move Slow and Upgrade, The Power of Incremental Innovation. The title Move Slow and Upgrade, of course, is a response to Mark Zuckerberg's old slogan, Move Fast and Break Things. Here in this book, you're advocating for a kind of gradual improvement that you call the upgrade, and which we'll, of course, get to. But maybe first we can establish something that I've gone over many times on the show, but just to say it out loud, what is the problem with moving fast?
There's two. So the book really focuses on two things. One of them has to do with this idea, which sounds so lovely that so many people are entranced by it, like it's the siren's call, is a vision that everything is about to change and it's going to be changing in the best way possible. We are living in the best of all times. This new way of doing something is going to upend all the old bad stuff and it's going to give us everything we've wanted and then some. And the book sort of points out two things. Usually when you hear that, the goods are not going to be delivered. This casino mentality bet is not going to pay off. And that when you're being presented this very rosy picture, there's a lot that's being left out. There's going to be a lot of harm and there's going to be a lot of cost. And so the two problems are usually we're not getting what we're told and we're going to be getting a lot of bad things that are not part of the initial sales pitch.
And I feel like we talk to people every day who are just so frustrated that we keep spending so much money on such disruptive responses to very real problems, only to see these half-baked technologies fail to get off the launch pad with us picking up the bill. And whether it's Elon Musk instituting Doge to upend all the privacy protections of the federal government, or the newest AI companies sucking up nearly every bit of data they can find about us, we keep seeing the ways that moving fast can break things, but we keep waiting for the time it actually fixes things. And here we're trying to show the alternative path.
I like how you put it near the beginning of the book. You write, innovations are when we use a dollar to buy a lottery ticket. Upgrades are when we put a dollar in the bank. And I think that's a good metaphor for people to understand that there are these two distinct different paths when we're deciding how to pursue innovation, or when we're watching companies pursue innovation. Some of them are just speculative lottery tickets. Actually, I should say most of what we're seeing today falls into that bucket, right?
It's not only that. It's that we keep doing it over and over again, right? I mean, that's sort of the point of the book, because you're right. Of course, a lot of what we've talked about in very specific chapters about very specific things, this is exactly the moment that we're living in now. Everybody and their brother and their cousin and their uncle and their sister and so on is being told, if you are not AI first in whatever you're doing, you're going to be outdated. And that if you weren't AI first yesterday, you're even going to be further behind. And so people are just given this message over and over and over again. And the message, sadly, it does fit themes that we've talked about before. And we're very worried about what that kind of message can do.
And look, the same technologies are being sold all around the world, but we're talking about a very particular type of failure we see in America in particular, where the same sorts of high-tech sales pitches are leading people to just waste so much money, so much time, so much energy. And we see it not just leading government leaders astray and the, you know, heads of Fortune 50 companies, but we talk about how this innovation mindset has really undermined the way that we think about problem solving in just about every area of public life in the US, and what the alternative is. What are the ways you can find those somber, boring, evidence-based alternatives that aren't just going to be buying more losing lottery tickets and actually being putting money in the bank?
Yeah, you call this the gospel of evidence-based incremental change. I thought that was a nice tagline for what you're trying to advocate for. And on the other hand, we have this cult of disruptive innovation. You talk about the so-called innovation speak, the language, the values, the ideologies of discontinuous innovation that Silicon Valley has been promoting and practicing for a number of years. But it's not just Silicon Valley. You write that the media routinely amplifies the bias of celebrating, if not worshiping, innovation while propping up the fairy tale of instantaneous transformation. Within the companies, there are compliance teams that are often rather weak. And you write that congressional hearings don't do much. And then there's the users themselves, the public, having been subjected to this avalanche of propaganda about this method of innovation. I mean, it seems like a really wicked problem when you have all the actors in the system marching in lockstep to this harmful ideology.
I think that's why, I mean, part of the challenge in writing this book and writing any book, you have to ask yourself, who are you writing for? And we think the book is helpful for every single person, but not every single person has as much power as everybody else. And so it would be lovely if people who have more ability to shape institutions or shape workplaces, you know, the people who are up in the C-suite and the people who are making the big decisions, could read a book like this, because the wicked problem that you're talking about, Mark, leaves a lot of people just feeling stuck and powerless. I mean, that's a huge part of the problem over and over again. Albert can talk about a roadmap. Lots of other people can talk about a roadmap, but you need people with buy-in. And part of the reason, I think we kind of get at this in the book, that people are shielded from doing the right thing is leadership feels like it's on a very short-term cycle. And so it's easy to follow the pack and it's easy to get motivated by FOMO. And you can rest assured that probably no one 3 years down the road is going to call you on it. You'll be on to your next project. You'll be on to the next big, great thing. So the lack of accountability allows this pattern to just keep going over and over again.
Let's get into some examples. The book is full of examples and case studies. Some of the examples you cover include Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse. Remember that? Cryptocurrency like Bitcoin and others. Amazon's Ring surveillance doorbell. AI, of course, figures into your examples. You talk about cybersecurity and more. Why don't we start with the metaverse, which was Zuck's, frankly, ridiculous idea that someday we would all live in a virtual reality world that was designed, owned, and controlled by him. You write that Zuck made the metaverse the top priority of his company in 2021. And before he shuttered the metaverse, which he did recently, he had ended up spending tens of billions of dollars on it. I think at one point you mentioned that that amount of money could have cured several cancers. But instead, Zuckerberg burned it in a giant bonfire trying to build this disruptive innovation that he called the metaverse. What happened there?
The metaverse is a great science fiction topic, and it's a terrible business plan. We've been reading about the metaverse for decades, and it's a really cool idea that you would have this alternative world you could live in, that you could work in, that you could build your life in, that you would navigate using haptic feedback and virtual reality headsets. And, you know, Zuckerberg convinced his board, his investors, the press, that spending billions of dollars, renaming his company, refocusing their platforms, doing all of this based on the premise that the metaverse would be their salvation. It would be the next phase of what our virtual worlds looked like as people grew ever more disenchanted with the reality of social media. And it was a disaster, right? No one today seriously can argue that they're spending their lives in the metaverse. People are using their phones, people are using apps, but no one is considering this their parallel world. And it was the classic example of a massive innovation with no proven pathway, with no clear killer app, with no clear sense of what the upside utility would be for users. It was just a sales pitch. And Silicon Valley is great at convincing people that they should just get on board with the next big sales pitch. This fear of missing out on the next big innovation drives so many people to hide their skepticism. But whether it's Meta or the video game companies that spent billions and tens of billions on their own metaverse acquisitions, or any number of metaverse land speculators, there is a whole movement that we tend to erase from the historical technological narrative, because it just really cements this point that we keep hitting in the book, and which we often forget collectively, that innovation so often misses the mark.
The one thing I would just add really quickly, we point this out, and I think it's really sad, and it's not the last time that this point of vulnerability is going to be pressed. It's too easy to mock the enthusiasm after it fades, right? You're like, what were people thinking? And then you think that we're somehow more sophisticated now and we're not going to fall for the other thing. But metaverse hype was not that long ago, and it really was rampant. And there was something kind of quasi-religious about it. And I think this move will keep happening now in the AI space, which is that one of the ways you found Zuckerberg and the team talking about it was as a way of almost redeeming our broken humanity. It was a version of the pitch they gave us initially with social media. The world is really tough, but now online, you'll be able to connect with people you wouldn't otherwise meet. You'll be able to share ideas. You'll become a better person. it's going to be this online Shangri-La. And of course, things turned out exactly the opposite, right? It fueled more polarization and misinformation and disinformation, massive issues with younger people and the kinds of unrealistic, idealized images that become popular. And so it felt like as people were seeing through, and it took a little bit of time, but seeing through the lie of the version of social media that he presented, this was a way of re-upping that story. Okay, so analog reality is really hard. You're stuck in this body and there's only so much you can do with it. You're stuck in this particular place. Wouldn't it be great if all bets were off and we could offer you something totally new that's just going to empower everybody? And there's something kind of messianic about it. So in the absence of what we should be asking, which is what is the killer app? Like, what is the specific problem to be solved? And how is this technology contributing towards it? It was a seductive worldview.
And one thing I want to just make clear, we're not just coming to this now in the aftermath of the car crash. We look at all of the warning signs that were flashing in front of people's faces every step along the way, because the failure pattern here, it's not just a way we can learn from the past. It's a way we can see these same patterns repeating again in the future, in a way that once you understand the innovation curse, that understand the sort of way that people keep misunderstanding the way that technology advances, that you can actually be better equipped in your own life and in your community to push back against these narratives.
Yeah, that's one thing I really appreciate about this book, is that you're going to great pains to pull out the lessons, to say, here are the patterns of how Silicon Valley makes these oversized claims with, you know, disruptive innovation, and see how they failed. Get ready for the next wave. Whatever it is, learn from these patterns. In fact, the final chapter of the book is an explicit list of those patterns. Watch out for these, I think it was seven, these seven patterns when you hear the hype the next time. This is not just, as you said, Evan, it's not just someone afterwards saying, yeah, yeah, look, they failed. No, you're trying to point out why these things fail in a bid to teach us and really the companies too, if they would just listen, how to avoid these giant bonfires of tens of billions of dollars in the future. The other thing before we move on, I just wanted to also point out this idea of this quasi-religious talk that Zuckerberg was using. It reminds me of an early demo of the metaverse that I remember. I forget what year this would have been, but this was shortly after Zuckerberg announced the metaverse. And this was still in the era when it was just like a floating head and torso. There were no legs. And he was promoting the metaverse as an empathy machine. You point this out also in the metaverse chapter, that if you give yourself over to this technology, you will develop your powers of empathy for people who are less fortunate or people who were suffering from some, in this case, a natural disaster. So the specific example I'm thinking of is when he had his virtual reality avatar floating around actual video footage of a disaster in Puerto Rico. And he was doing this to show how enlightened and how extra empathetic you can be. You know, as a billionaire, floating your digital avatar around video of actual human suffering. And he really got some PR blowback from that. I mean, that's one of the rare times people really push back hard against this VR stuff. But you saw this all the way through. As you said, Evan, they're presenting this as you can make yourself a better human being if you use our technology.
It is almost like astonishing. Like, did they talk to any actual journalists? I mean, ever since people have been discussing the CNN effect, if not before that, it's been sort of widely known that people are constantly bombarded with moving images. So showing people something moving isn't the core problem. Like, if we're trying to figure out why enough issues in the world that require more political will aren't gaining the traction that they need, it's not because people aren't seeing images of horrible things. Like, it's not like if only we had some really moving images, we could solve that. Journalists have been struggling with this for a really long time.
Well, Evan, those are 2D images. I mean, having a headset changes everything.
And we should also mention that Apple had its own foray into VR with the Apple Vision Pro, this headset, rather bulky and heavy headset that they had for a while. I think they have mostly or completely turned that off. I did a whole show on this right after they announced it, talking about what a horrible idea this whole thing was. I called it the face jail. And I stand by that, the Apple face jail. I think that would have sold a few more units. Let's move on. Let's leave the metaverse behind, all of us, please. And let's go to cryptocurrency. Write a whole chapter on cryptocurrency. And I want to set this up with a great quote from that chapter. You write, "Perhaps no technology embodies the hype, excesses, and failures of innovation better than cryptocurrency. The array of poorly understood technologies that have generated unprecedented wealth while consistently failing to deliver on their promise of a better financial world." So here again, cryptocurrency like Bitcoin showed up. It was a way for the tech oligarchs behind the technology to try to make lots of money very quickly, but they sold it as a way of helping people. They said it's going to help the unbanked. So what was the, and I know there was more pitch than just that, but tell us, how did cryptocurrency fit the same pattern that what we saw in the metaverse?
Yeah, and with cryptocurrency, there are countless thousands of different crypto products out there now, probably tens of thousands, unknowable numbers. But we focus on Bitcoin and Ethereum, two of the oldest cryptocurrencies and the ones that constitute the dominant market share. And we looked at the sales pitches that had been made for the value they would provide society from the beginning, right? Because people talk about crypto with dollar signs in their eyes because here you have this thing that within my lifetime has gone from trading for pennies to trading for tens of thousands of dollars. So people have amassed huge fortunes. But then there's the question of what does it do, right? And so there's the part of this that's basically a digital tulip, right? We've seen people just having commodities boom since, famously there was a tulip boom in the Middle Ages in Holland that made people tremendously wealthy until it bust and made people tremendously impoverished. And we've seen any number of commodities having these hype cycles over the years. Think of Beanie Babies, think of any number of things. But oftentimes people would conflate the fact that Bitcoin has gotten more expensive with Bitcoin is doing its job. So what is its job? Well, part of that job was to be a currency. Well, Bitcoin is terrible as a currency, right? We don't measure prices in crypto. The prices shift so frequently in relation to, US dollar and the things we actually value things in that it's not a usable pricing mechanism. And also the people who really believe in crypto as the future, they're holding on to their crypto so it goes up in value. They're not going to go and buy a latte using their cryptocurrency. That's their retirement fund. That's their generational wealth. They're holding it to the moon and beyond. And so there's this real paradox in like, well, you think it's super valuable, so you're holding on to it, but you think the reason it's valuable is it's supposedly a currency, which it clearly isn't. But beyond people not using it as currency, there's the fact that when you try to actually use it that way, the mechanics are awful. It can take a huge amount of time for transactions to go through. During peak times, it can take hours, maybe days even, for things to actually settle on the blockchain. It can be incredibly expensive. The way cryptocurrencies work is that essentially you pay people for using their computers to process transactions. This is something called a gas fee. And that's sort of part of the pricing structure. So if I'm sending Mark a Bitcoin, these third parties are going to make a part of that Bitcoin for processing the transaction. But you don't know what that gas fee is at the time when you process the transaction. And that can be orders of magnitude larger than for existing currencies. So it's something that isn't good for tracking prices, isn't good for making transactions, is slow when you use it to buy something, is expensive when you use it to buy something, and then failed to actually be a hedge against financial instability and inflation. And so we kept going back and checking all of the different claims that were made in support of Bitcoin, in support of Ethereum, in support of these cryptocurrencies, and say, well, how's that panning out? And certainly when you think about the most vulnerable communities, you know, people who are unbanked, people who have barriers to accessing a checking account, who pay extortionate check cashing fees, the things that have helped them the most, they aren't some novel cryptographic payment platform. It's having easier access to free bank accounts. It's postal banking. It's starting to look at the unintended consequences of bank secrecy and know your customer laws. And so it's really these much more boring evidence-based alternatives that solve the issues around people being unbanked. And meanwhile, the cryptocurrency boosters just keep shouting about how great their currency is from their yachts while hoping that the yacht and the currency don't sink.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Evan Salinger and Albert Fox Kahn, co-authors of the book Move Slow and Upgrade: The Power of Incremental Innovation. It's published by Cambridge University Press, a book I liked a lot. As you heard in the first half of the interview, we covered the bad idea called the metaverse that burned $80 billion in a bid for some sort of disruptive innovation that was in Mark Zuckerberg's mind. And now we're in the midst of talking about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and others. In both cases, disruptive innovations that came with a lot of promise, but as Albert and Evan are saying, maybe they were not designed with the recipients or the constituents of these technologies in mind. And that led to obvious and inevitable problems, a pattern we'll hear in the second half of the interview. If you'd like more information on the book and on the guests for today's show, go to the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and click the episode link for Move Slow and Upgrade. Let's listen to the second half of my interview here on Tectonic. Whenever I cover crypto on this show and I mention all the downsides, slow transactions, not helping the unbanked, the rampant fraud, and so on and so forth, I often will get an email or two from listeners saying one of two things. One is, sure, Bitcoin is bad, but have you tried Solana or some other cryptocurrency? So there's this almost religious debate about which cryptocurrency is the true, the good, the one that actually does work as promised. And then the other pushback I get that's very common is, Sure, cryptocurrency is bad, but let me tell you about the blockchain, which can do amazing things like smart contracts. So that's one where they say, okay, all the cryptocurrencies are bad, Bitcoin, Solana, Ethereum, all of them, but the underlying technology is actually good. Do you get pushback like that when you talk about crypto?
Oh, yeah. And as a lawyer, I think smart contracts in a lot of these deployments are incredibly dumb. We look at the ways that people try to push DAOs, these decentralized autonomous organizations, and try to create all of these complicated infrastructure using the blockchain. And when you talk to computer scientists about the vast majority of the ways that the blockchain is pulled out as an excuse to do something, it's oftentimes more cumbersome, more expensive, more error prone than just having a, you know, SQL database or some like traditional form of backend data analytics that's able to do the exact same function. And with all of the cryptocurrencies we've looked at, not only do you have these persistent design limitations, but like, even when you go to one that works faster, you know, Solana can process a lot more transactions, and even, you know, the latest updates to Bitcoin, Ethereum, and all of that. But when you compare it to the amount of money that goes through the SWIFT system internationally or the ACH banking system domestically, it's a drop in the bucket. This is such a cumbersome way to do banking at scale that it really, even in the best form that people are able to put forward, it's still not able to keep up with a lot of these existing applications. And then there are things that cryptocurrency is never able to address, like the fact that in every payments platform we've had up until now, we've recognized the fact that mistakes happen. People occasionally goof, they enter the wrong account number, they send the wrong amount. And so we have built into banking in every country around the world this ability to undo a mistaken transaction. You don't have that in cryptocurrency. So if you're a company that's processing 100,000 transactions a day, and you know that you're going to have a portion of those, even if it's a tiny fraction, you know, a real significant number of transactions where people goof, how can you use a platform where you can't get your money back when you make that sort of mistake? And I think if cryptocurrency advocates actually believed in the technology, and they actually thought the technology were fit for purpose, we would never have seen this massive move to exchanges like FTX, exchanges that said, oh, you don't have to deal with the cryptocurrency directly. You don't have to process everything on the blockchain. You can just use the exchange. And of course, what that got us was Sam Bankman-Fried. It got us the worst of both worlds, a world where you had financial transactions that weren't in any way linked to the underlying math of cryptocurrencies and the blockchain, and also weren't in any way regulated by the structures we turn to in the existing banking ecosystem to prevent fraud.
When we wrote this, and Albert, you know, wanted to take the lead, I was like, how can we clearly do what Albert just did, right? Which was decouple the speculative quality of an investment from the broader social sales pitch. And that's also a pattern, again, that we keep seeing. Like, if we were to tie this back to the metaverse, on the one hand, sometimes you had like very seemingly product-specific visions. Like, it could just be a gaming platform, or like it could be a more interactive Zoom. But that was never enough. It always had to be sold with this broader social. We're going to fix these broader things. So the way that Albert just outlined it is great for talking about crypto, and it's a great segue between those chapters. Isn't it interesting that these are never just sold to us as a way of doing X? They come with this whole vast apparatus, and that's also a telltale sign.
Yeah, that's a pattern that repeats across the book, the metaverse, crypto, and beyond in your examples. This idea that the hype is promising this all-encompassing solution to some giant social problem or challenge versus just building a targeted technology that would do one thing really well is never good enough for the Silicon Valley companies and the VCs that are looking for, you know, 1,000x return on their investment. Let's move on to another chapter you have called Home Security Upgrades. This focuses on one particular case study, which is the Amazon Ring surveillance doorbell. For Tectonic listeners who've been listening for a while, they'll be familiar with my feelings about surveillance doorbells. In fact, I did a show not long ago with Chris Gilliard on the revelations that Ring is spying on us, something nicely visualized in an ad during the Super Bowl by Amazon itself, showing an entire neighborhood being surveilled by a network of these Ring cameras.
Can we just pause on that for a second, Mark? Because that was such an interesting misfire that speaks so directly to the book. execs at Amazon had to have thought, given the cost of a Super Bowl ad. So we're not just talking about any old ad, right? We're talking about some of the most expensive ad space out there, that you could win people over with mass surveillance, just ad puppy. And obviously it didn't work. People get pressured. People are oversold on surveillance all the time. But to really think that you're going to convince people, wouldn't it be great if at like almost the press of a button, all of these rings could act in coordination to find Lassie? I mean, people could see through that, but the fact that it had to crash and burn shows these companies just become so almost, it's like they're mesmerized by their own talisman. They've been saying the mantra for so long that it's not just about hoodwinking the gullible. They come to believe the completely untenable thing themselves.
Yeah, the own goal, I guess we could call it, was pretty striking. Actually, somebody suggested that the Amazon Ring ad was so bad, maybe it was a secret whistleblower inside Amazon who came up with a concept to alert Americans about what was happening. I mean, it really was that bad. How could they not understand how this was going to go over? But I think you're right, Evan. It goes in tandem with the disruptive innovator's mindset that they're going to do whatever they want and not listen to anybody. And that carries over into their ads. We're going to run this and it's going to be great. If they had spent 5 minutes talking to people outside of Amazon, they probably would have learned that that was going to be a bad idea for a commercial.
But I think this speaks to, again, a pattern we've seen over and over. It's anathema to want to do so, because part of the disruptive mentality is a cult of genius, a cult of standing above it all. If you need feedback from other people, then other people have something to offer you. You are then listening, but instead you want to be shaping. You want to be the one dictating. You want to be the one creating, right? This is all part of the culture. And so, yeah, it's not surprising that a level of insularity and a level of refusal to want to hear from other people is very much part of the conception of I'm a world historical figure, or we're a world historical, we are change agents. It's all built into that.
All right, let's talk about the Ring itself. You write in the chapter that surveillance innovations like Amazon Ring function as more of a public safety threat than a public safety solution. And for listeners who are not familiar with surveillance studies, that might be a little counterintuitive. They may be thinking, well, you know, surveillance is bad and all, but you do put cameras everywhere. It's probably going to cut down on crime. Why are you saying that it's more of a public safety threat to do that?
Yeah, I mean, we looked into this for years at a surveillance technology oversight project. When we looked at Ring's own assertions about the ability to reduce crime, we found the data wasn't there. And actually, that when people were going on the ground and looking at the impact of installing Ring cameras, that there was some evidence of potentially having a counterintuitive effect and crime rates potentially increasing. We've seen for decades that CCTV, that these constant installations of video cameras aren't able to prevent crime. Sometimes they help in investigating crime after the fact. There's mixed evidence there, but it's a preventative matter. They're just a flop. And with Ring, it's not just the inability to create this force field that they tried to advertise against harm. It's the fact that you're inviting all of these prying eyes into your own home, because we've seen people who installed Ring cameras in the hopes of protecting their family, then finding those cameras aimed at them, whether it was people who broke in, violated the law and hacked into their Ring system, or people like police departments who use force of law to gain access to those Ring camera feeds. We've seen people who were asked by officers to essentially spy on their neighbors, hand over Ring footage from the outside of their home. And when they refused, officers came back with a warrant, not just for the cameras on the outside of the house, but for the cameras on the inside as well, seizing all of this data. And even worse, because this information lives oftentimes on Amazon servers, oftentimes it's Amazon, not the homeowner, who gets this request from the police in the first place. And so oftentimes homeowners won't even know that their own camera system has been commandeered by the cops this way until long after it happened.
Savannah Guthrie's mom and that story speaks very much also to what Albert was talking about. I mean, this wasn't Amazon Ring. It was a different online surveillance system. But I think the rules were supposed to be that the service that the Guthries were paying for meant that this information shouldn't have been available on the cloud after a certain point. And suddenly it was. And that raised a really big question about, well, wait a minute, what's been going on the whole time? So there's certainly these deep questions about like what's actually happening versus what people expect. But to the initial point that Albert was making, I just want to restate it, because when I have talked to just like average people who have read the, like not people that are in surveillance world or privacy world or who are academics, they read the chapter and they go, so I get it. You place a high value on civil liberties. And so you think that's more important than, and I'm like, no, then you really didn't understand the chapter. Even really intelligent people reading, it's a very, it feels like such a counterintuitive point. We're like, yes, we do make some civil liberties claims in the chapter. There are truly some privacy and civil liberties issues. And if you're not thinking about them, you're not understanding what networked home surveillance is. But we're not making the claim, we're not just making the claim that you should care about that stuff. There is an unproven efficacy issue. And we just have it so built into our culture that if you can put up a camera, you will be in an important way deterring. It feels like that's become a kind of common sense. So people really have a hard time just even thinking that that might not be true. It's a very hard point to get across.
And it's hardly the only downside. I mean, you also bring up the culture of fear and paranoia that tends to come up around communities that have overinvested in these surveillance cameras, because everyone's looking at their surveillance camera feed all the time, trying to find the bad guy. And that tends to fray the social bonds that would otherwise be there if people were just, you know, relating normally on the street, neighbor to neighbor, person to person, rather than going through Amazon or some other big tech company.
That was part of the vision, right? I mean, you can't have an innovative thing if it's merely just, oh, it's a camera. We've seen cameras, right? It's a camera plus some data storage. Okay, what's the big thing here? But if you can convince people, which Amazon really tried to, we're basically deputizing you. You should be a good neighbor. Like, don't we remember those days when neighbors looked after neighbors, right? A kind of very like nostalgic thing. Well, clearly those days are gone, but we can bring that back. Now you can do it. So along with the technology came a kind of encouragement. And that type of encouragement, when you used, you know, the app that went with it, where you're constantly being made to feel on edge and threatened, it is foreseeably a toxic mix.
Well, there's a lot to appreciate about this book, both the examples you're giving and also the patterns you're drawing out to help teach us what we should look out for in the next time Silicon Valley comes with a new technology. And one of the most important patterns I took away is an old concept that I've advocated for years, which is to think about the needs of the users before building a new innovation. As you write in the book, many of the worst innovations are designed without the voices of those most impacted by their creation. As a final question, what is it going to take to change things so that the companies and now government agencies making these decisions with technology actually include the needs of their constituents in the design and the creation of these systems?
So for me, despite working in this field, despite seeing all these technological misadventures, I'm still an optimist. And I think one of the things that makes me optimistic right now is that I think we're in such a volatile, self-destructive AI hype cycle that things are going to go off the rails. When the bubble we're seeing around AI optimism potentially busts, there's going to be an opportunity to really come in and have a much more robust discussion about technological governance, about reasserting the sort of democratic control, about actually learning from this moment. No, it's folly to make predictions about future technologies. And so maybe, you'll look back on this interview in 2 years and be like, oh, he really had no idea what was going. But at least for me, I think one of the patterns I tend to see is that it's hard to learn these lessons in the moment of enthusiasm, but we can actually do quite a bit in the hangover after the party starts to fade.
The only thing that I would add, and maybe unfortunately, it just doesn't happen at scale, right? So I'm with Albert on this. I think there will be a course correction because there will have to be. And it's sort of sad when you want anticipatory governance and you know what's coming ahead and you wish there could be better decisions, but economic capture and regulatory capture and FOMO and all of these things kind of prevent this. However, not everybody marches in lockstep, right? I mean, that's the other thing to keep in mind. So there are people who, when you talk to about this, they go, no, I totally hear what you're saying, right? Like, I'm a small business owner and I recognize that if I just sit here and go, how can I use AI? Because I have to use AI to become more efficient, there's a pretty good chance I'm going to be making my workflows actually less efficient. Or like AI slop is going to be handed to people in my company and it's going to decrease morale because now they're going to have more work to do. Like not everybody's going to hear that, but some people do. So if anything, if there's any heartening message in the interim while we're kind of working this out, it's that everybody doesn't buy into the hype to the same extent. And so sometimes you are having these sort of smaller level conversations and there's something meaningful about that.
The book is called Move Slow and Upgrade: The Power of Incremental Innovation. It's published by Cambridge and written by both of you, Evan Selinger and Albert Fox Kahn. I really enjoyed this conversation. I wish you the best with the book and hope you'll be back on the show sometime.
Would love that. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. And will remain so for the several minutes still in the show. We just heard my interview with Evan Selinger and Albert Fox Kahn talking about their book, Move Slow and Upgrade: The Power of Incremental Innovation, a book I liked a lot. And you heard that we went over several of the case studies in the book, although not all of them. There's a lot more material in the book than we had time to get to, but I thought those examples, the metaverse and cryptocurrency and the Ring doorbell, surveillance doorbells, gave you a sense of what Albert and Evan are trying to point out, which is that it is much better if the companies would think about what the users actually want, rather than just pushing something out with no thought beyond what the oligarch thinks is cool or what is going to deliver some short-term boost of media coverage. Because we can, as I said at the top of the show, we can see the results of this disruptive innovation, this move fast and break things approach, and generally, it's not very good. So I just want to read again this sentence I liked a lot from the book. Innovations are when we use a dollar to buy a lottery ticket. Upgrades are when we put a dollar in the bank. And Evan and Albert are saying we should be investing in the long run. We should be investing dollars rather than just buying lottery tickets. I also appreciated that Evan brought up during the interview this idea of the culture of genius that these oligarchs and these startup founders who are so highly capitalized by the VCs, they see themselves as world historical figures. They're change agents. And as Evan said, as a person like that, a change agent, you want to be dictating. You definitely don't want to be listening to others. Because what could be worse than listening to others? when you were thinking about what to build. And the book said, and this is another quote that I read off, many of the worst innovations are designed without the voices of those most impacted by their creation. And the quote continues, innovators are quick to tell these individuals what they need to have a better life, but so slow to ask what would actually help. And that reminds me of, if I can tell this in 3 minutes, one of my favorite stories of innovation gone wrong, because it doesn't include asking people what would help, is this this thing from about 20 years ago called the Play Pump, which was a children's merry-go-round or roundabout you might see on playgrounds, that this American, basically a startup, came up with this idea to install it in African villages that needed more clean drinking water. And kids would spin around like on a playground, and it would be cleverly connected to an underground water pump that would pump the water without the women of the village having to pump their own laboriously at some hand pump. And so what ended up happening is the Play Pump won a lot of design awards and got a lot of media publicity and a lot of investment. I mean, over $10 million went into this initiative. And it sounded really clever to a lot of people, but what actually happened is the startup never asked if those villages really wanted more playground equipment to pump their water. And the answer, of course, was no, they did not want that, because how it was rolled out is that installers would come to these villages and would go to the center of town and would actually disassemble the hand pump that was the source of water for the entire village. And in its place, they would install this merry-go-round. And then they would leave. And the people would all gather around this merry-go-round and say, what in the world is this supposed to do? I mean, we had a hand pump that worked perfectly fine. And then the kids would spin for a few minutes and then get tired and move on to something else. And then it was left to the women of the village to just stand there and turn this play pump, turn this merry-go-round to pump the water out. And it turned out that the play pump took 6 times as long as a hand pump. It wasn't designed for efficiency. So now it was taking a lot longer for the women of the village to pump their water. And that's not even the worst thing, because within a few weeks, the play pump, an untested technology that was installed without anyone asking for it, ended up breaking. And the villages had not received any replacement parts or training or contact number for service. And so a lot of villages then ended up having no water at all because of this misbegotten idea. And so the women would then have to walk several kilometers over to a neighboring village to use their hand pump if the village still had a hand pump. So this play pump was just a giant mistake, and it's a case in point about what happens when disruptive innovation is laid out on constituents. It could be citizens or patients or students or users of any type, without first figuring out if that innovation is going to be helpful to those constituents. And when that happens on a broad scale, you end up in the tech dystopia that we have today. We're basically all living surrounded by play pumps all the time. These innovations that were just forced upon us without any thought of whether they would help us. In fact, sometimes it's the very reverse, that they were designed with malicious intent to surveil us, to manipulate us, to predate on us, to exploit us, far from being designed to actually help us. And so this book from Evan Selinger and Albert Foxconn is a welcome corrective to that approach. Move slow and upgrade, with lots of case studies about how Silicon Valley is doing it wrong and how we can actually conceive of doing it better. For those of us who are not building the technology, next time you hear some claim come from Silicon Valley saying, oh, this is the latest, greatest, most wonderful thing, you can use the case studies in this book as a kind of a penicillin and say, oh, I know those patterns. I have heard this hype before. I don't believe it, and I'm not going to use it if we can get away with avoiding it. That's about all the time I have for you today. Hope you found this interesting. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, you know exactly what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And to go out today, I thought we could hear Make a Circuit with Me by the Polecats. Have a great one, everybody.
And good evening, folks, and welcome to another edition of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music right here at listener-supported WFMU. I am your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here bringing this show to you every Monday evening at 7. I think I'm sort of fighting off a cold here, so pardon any nasality in my speech during the show. I'll try to keep my nose clean, as they say, for the duration of the show at least. Lots of good music for you now and forever. I'm going to start with a group that I talked about a week ago, 2 weeks ago. When was it? A couple weeks ago. And that is Motor Totemist Guild. I recently played the group U Totem, and I mentioned that they were a marriage of two groups, 5UUs and Motor Totemist Guild, and hence the merged name U Totem. So I'm going to play Motor Totemist Guild, who, as I always mention, I had to check the FMU playlist search page, which is a priceless resource. And to my surprise, I have not played the Motor Totemist Guild on this show on It's Complicated, so which is sort of good news because I can play them right now. I'm going to play a track from an album Originally released in 1984, Motor Totemist Guild were from California. They were led, I guess, the project of a guy named James Grigsby, multi-instrumentalist, but helped out by many, many musicians on this album and their other albums. They put out a few. So we're going to hear a record that was released in 1984. Did I just say that? Maybe I did, which was called Infradig. And what else can I tell you? It was recently reissued. It was at least reissued in digital form. I probably also CD, but I can't swear to it. But there was a 40th edition released, well, in 2024, do the math. And so we're going to hear a track from that. These guys were great, great. And we will be hearing a piece called The Totem Motorist. This is the Motor Totemist Guild.
Thank you.